Good morning. This is NBC's regular morning roundup of news from overseas and at home. First, let's hear what London has to report on this, the 604th day of war. Come in, London.
This is John McVane in London. German raiders last night made a two-hour attack on Plymouth. Fires were started, but casualties aren't thought to have been heavy. Thousands of firebombs were showered down on the town. Other parts of the country that reported raids were southwest England, south Wales, the south coast of England, and East Anglia. Some damage was done, but the communique says there weren't many casualties. One German bomber was destroyed, and two others are thought to have been shot down. British bombers last night attacked Brest for the 12th time since the German battle cruisers Scharnhorst and Gneisenau were reported to be in the harbor. Beginning at 8 o'clock, German long-range guns on the French coast shelled the Dover area for several hours this morning. Reports from the Channel Coast say the Royal Air Force is believed to be making a daylight raid, dropping heavy bombs in the general region of Cape Grenet, where the German gun positions are. After about 3 hours, the German shelling of the Dover area increased in intensity. The Germans, who began with single shells, started firing 4 and 6 gun salvos. It's believed to be the longest and the hardest shelling that the Germans have yet carried out across the Channel. Authoritative military circles in London today stated that the evacuation of the British forces from Greece was still continuing. They didn't give any figures or details. It is stated that Sollum has been evacuated by the British, but that the enemy has made no further progress. The three small Axis columns that crossed the Egyptian frontier on April 26 are said to be converging on the Halfaya Pass above Sollum. They are being harassed by the British. Military quarters here deny that Tobruk is beleaguered or encircled, and they say that the enemy has been forced to take up defensive positions. It was announced this morning that the British have captured Kombolsia, about 15 miles east of Dessier in Abyssinia, and the site of an important aerodrome. The British government today asked the United States government to make inquiries from the Germans as to the whereabouts of Sir Ronald Campbell, formerly British Minister to Belgrade. The Italians are said to have captured and detained Sir Ronald. Even though the average person in London can buy only about 20 cents worth of meat a week in the butcher shops, that 20 cents worth may be hard to get this week. The reason is a strike of 3,000 meat porters, called because recently the manager and all employees of a wholesale meat depot were dismissed after the depot had been destroyed by bombs. The meat porter's strike means that meat isn't being shifted from the wholesale depots to the butcher shops. So far, the strike is unofficial. Most of the strikers are members of the transport union, and yesterday an official of the union stated that the union had an understanding with the employers' association that if a depot were bombed, the men would be transferred to other depots. Negotiations are said to be underway. The strike may affect restaurants, but it will not affect hospitals. London housewives are having an orange hunt. Some 26,000 cases of oranges arrived from Spain last week. Ordinarily, that would mean about 8 million oranges for distribution in the greater London area, which takes in a large part of southern England. In this area live about 16 million people, so theoretically, everyone should have about half an orange. Yesterday, women were queuing up in front of their grocery stores to be on hand when the doors opened. But many found no oranges were to be had. Reporters from London papers have been searching London grocers for the elusive fruit, but in only one or two instances have they reported finding any. Dark rumors are flying among women shoppers of grocers concealing secret hoards of oranges to be given to favorite customers only. One ugly hint that is being bandied about from housewife to housewife runs to the effect that grocers are using the oranges, which must be sold at a controlled price, to lure shoppers into paying exorbitant prices for vegetables whose price isn't controlled. Fruit wholesalers and retailers blame muddled control for bad distribution of the fruit. So far, nobody has blamed Fifth Columnists. I succeeded in getting a half dozen oranges the other day. People in Florida or California wouldn't have recognized them as oranges. They were tiny, orange-like things that resembled the little fruit of those orange trees you sometimes see growing in a flower pot in the living room. Each orange yielded about a tablespoonful of juice. You got the idea that whoever originally sold them to the British market as oranges pulled a business deal that should put him in the Hall of Fame, along with the man who sold Brooklyn Bridge to the countryman on his first visit to New York. British military experts today estimate the total armored strength of the German army at about 6,500 light, medium, and heavy tanks. They range in weight from about 6 to 40 tons. It's said that in spite of their massive tanks, the Germans have nothing as good as the British military tank, whose job is to destroy the German tanks. The fighting in Greece is believed to have shown that the British don't need better tanks, but more tanks, with increased speed and radius of action. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
Here are some late bulletins received in the NBC newsroom. From Berlin, it's learned that Crete, Greece's largest island and now the seat of her government and a base for the British, is next in line for a German drive. The Volkischer Beobachter, Adolf Hitler's newspaper, declares Crete no longer is a pleasant anchoring place for English warships. The newspaper points out that every mile of the Nazi advance across the Peloponnesus brings Crete, with its big Sudan Bay naval base, into closer and more effective range of Greek-based German bombers. The long, narrow island extends from 70 to 160 miles southeast of Laconia, the nearest part of the Peloponnesus. The Greek premier, Emmanuel Souderos, declared at Canea, Crete yesterday that Greeks would fight on from there. Destiny, he said, has chosen two islands as the last but worthy ramparts of the free peoples of Europe, the great island of Britain and this great island of the Hellenes. Informed sources say Crete in German hands would spell the greatest danger to British Near East strongholds, to Alexandria and Port Said in Egypt, and to the Suez Canal. They say the flying time for Nazi long-range bombers operating against Egypt now from Sicily would be cut by more than half once Crete were available to the Luftwaffe. Germans already are talking of new tasks in a larger sphere for the Nazi forces. Although these new tasks have not been specified, a military spokesman predicts that action in the Mediterranean theater will continue. He says conquest of Greece was regarded as only a phase of a larger plan now unfolding. German military reports from Greece say German troops cooperating with the Reich's naval forces occupied the island of Thasos, in addition to the Aegean islands of Samothrace and Lemnos, off the Aegean mouth of the Dardanelles. Thasos lies nearer the Greek mainland than the other two, and farther from the Turkish-guarded sea gate from the Aegean to the Black Sea. It still is not specified what naval forces were involved in the operations. German newspapers stress the importance of Samothrace and Lemnos particularly. They point out the Bay of Mudros on Lemnos served as a British naval base during the World War. They added that it was from Lemnos that the World War Allies started the campaign in which they tried to take the Dardanelles, an attempt frustrated by combined German and Turkish efforts. And that's the news in London and Berlin. Now let's listen to Earl Godwin's report from the newsroom in Washington.
In the coal and defense industries, when most of the East went to bed last night, there was a deadlock in the soft coal dispute which seemed insoluble. We wake up this morning with newspapers and radio chortlers gleefully announcing the fact that the mines will reopen, the men will go back to work, and the adamant trio of southern coal mine owners have not merely capitulated to the president's idea of working while you negotiate, but the southern coal mine owners agree to terms which are more generous than the terms which last night were described as completely out of the window and beyond reason. Jesse Jones, mild-mannered, forceful, tremendously human Secretary of Commerce, is credited with this job, performing this miracle. In the past in Washington, from the days of the Blue Eagle and the NRA down to the current time, Washington from time to time has resounded with the smacking sound of crackdowns or threats thereof, with nothing in consequence except the echo. But here this morning, we have the amazing example of straightforward negotiations on the telephone. The whole stoppage in the coal industry rested on an issue that would add about 3.5 cents a ton to the cost of producing coal in the South. Operators and miners in 70% of the industry's area have been ready to go to work for 8 days past, and we were told yesterday that only 3 mine owners in the South were holding out. There was the deadlock. The president had suggested that the mines reopen and that work go on while the problems were solved around the table. Well, up to quitting time last night, the country was faced with what Ed McGrady, former Assistant Secretary of Labor, now a labor consultant to the War Department, said would be catastrophic consequences. Who knows now, except those involved just what persuasiveness Jesse Jones used. Did he turn on the heat, or did he offer them a bit of political and financial taffy? Or is it possible he knows some of their secrets? Or did he just make them ashamed of themselves like a big boy straightening out a bad little fellow in short pants? Of course, as overlord of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, Jesse Jones controls any amount of possible money and credit aid to these and all other mine owners. At any rate, what seemed to us to be the hardest and most dangerous of the labor difficulties so far has been overcome without fireworks and without cracking down, and overnight, the southern mine owners agree to raise their basic daily wage from $5.60 a day to $6.60 a day. They further agree to go to work, and to enter into negotiations with the mine union for a further raise to $7. That has been the hard nut to crack, that 40 cents a day. And the result of the argument over that 40 cents difference shall be retroactive to the day the mines open. Last night there seemed to be, as I said when I started, an insoluble problem, a deadlock that nobody could open. This morning, sweetness and light, the mines are on their way to reopening, and steel furnaces, which had to shut down a few days ago, will be restored to production. And the Supreme Court held yesterday that railroads and the Pullman Company must offer to Negroes traveling from one state to another the same accommodations offered to all else. This, it seems, would stop southern state so-called Jim Crow laws under which Negroes have not been able to purchase Pullman accommodations as far as interstate travel is concerned. That will be out the window. No less important to millions of Americans is the fact that the Army, at least, has no intention of asking for a change in the draft ages. You've heard a great deal about the proposed lowering of the draft low limit to 18. However, there will not be any such request come from the War Department at present, nor any extension of the one-year training period that will be asked for by the Army, and that comes straight from General George Marshall, who is the Army Chief of Staff. But even more widespread would be the interest if this government could reach into every housewife's food budget and nick her a nickel or a dime on every pound of coffee, every pound of tea, every pound of cocoa, every pound of sugar. You know, that would be taxing what the politicians well call the poor man's breakfast table. It has been done in these last few hectic decades, I understand, and if you will recall, it was a tax on tea that started things in 1776. Well, oddly enough, this current proposal was proposed as a means of raising about $600 million for next year by the tax experts of Congress itself. Congress, mind you, whose members have to raise and spend the money by law and then go out and be reelected by the same folks they tax. A difficult process. Well, Henry Morgenthau, Jr., Secretary of the Treasury, opposes this with considerable vigor. They could not have picked worse examples, said the soft-spoken Treasury head yesterday. A tax on foods is a tax on the poor man's table. There, see, I know it. But the New York Chamber of Commerce recommends a general sales tax on everything, including foods. And that would mean whenever you make a purchase at any store, you leave a bit for Uncle Sam, too. Of course, that's well known in many states of the country. The New York Chamber of Commerce figures this is an easy way to raise $2,400,000,000 out of the $3,500,000,000 needed for next year. Sales taxes are not ace high with the administration, which still sticks to sticking the incomes of the country down to the same point as at present and no lower, but with rather tremendous increases. And as far as I know, Colonel Charles Lindbergh is still in the Army. His resignation, which he put out to the public before it reached here, had not been received either by the White House or the Secretary of War late last night. And that's all from Washington at this time.
Again, we remind our listeners that this station carries many newscasts each day to keep you fully informed of world developments. Our schedule is in your newspaper. We also suggest you remain tuned to this station for good entertainment. This is the National Broadcasting Company.